What is up? Welcome to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. I'm Jamie Dodd. My co-host is Canucks insider Thomas Drantz, who also covers the team for The Athletic. Canucks Talk brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We are live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Drancer, it's good to be back on the show. How's it going, man?
Oh, it's going well. Going very well down in California. Rooting for the American Hockey League Conference Final to get to Game 6. That's a full-time preoccupation. And otherwise enjoying the sunshine, some hikes, some time with the dog, and thinking about Canucks off-season topics.
Of course, as always. And I understand you did just a bang-up, phenomenal job on the show yesterday, judging by the group chat. I wasn't listening,
yeah,
but that was the impression I got.
Which made me sus, to be totally honest with you.
It's usually not that supportive a group, so that was quite odd. No. Like, hey, you're doing great today, buddy. It's like, wait, what? Why would you say that?
I was like, oh my God, am I really screwing this up? And everyone's like cheering for the last kid in the race. Like, you can do it.
Good hustle, man. Way to give it your all. Yeah. That was really good. Like, uh-oh. Anyways, yeah, as you said, we are constantly thinking about the Canucks offseason here, so we'll get into that. We'll look at the Stanley Cup final matchup, because, boy, do we have a lot of time to really dig in and analyze that from every possible angle. Sean Gentile will join us at 12:30, and Daniel Wagner from Passage to Bulis will talk Canucks and Canucks draft stories as well. Of course, he's got the new book out, so Daniel Wagner will join us at 1. But let's start with some Canucks offseason content, which I know you're hard at work pumping out at The Athletic as well. And, you know, the piece you had up today, just kind of looking at an overview of what can the Canucks kind of reasonably expect from some of their key prospects and young players as well, I would throw into that mix, right? Like Vasily Podkolzin kind of straddling the line between prospect and young NHL player. So how does the kind of youth in their system, either prospect or NHL player, figure into the roster dynamic next year? And there's layers to this, right? We can kind of go through the players individually. We can start with Vasily Podkolzin. There's also just kind of the big picture question of how much can you afford to kind of pencil in, or even more than that, write in pen in certain young players contributing? Like how many spaces can you leave open versus how much of it needs to be, you know, guys coming in and making a strong showing and forcing their way onto the team? But let's start with Vasily Podkolzin, right? Because, I mean, he's kind of the most NHL experienced guy, high draft pick, and it does feel like we're at a pretty crucial tipping point one way or another for Vasily Podkolzin's NHL career.
Yeah, although, do you remember when there was excitement about him in his rookie season? And like, one thing, and I don't want to get into confirmation bias with this either. Like, I do worry materially about Podkolzin's offensive upside at this stage, given the fact that he hasn't dominated in the American League as a 22 and a 23-year-old, given that his rookie year production hasn't been sustained, he hasn't been able to build on it, and obviously was sort of a non-entity from a bottom-line perspective, even if I liked aspects of his game down the stretch this season. You know, having signed with the club a two-year sort of show-me bridge, you know, very much in line with the Nils Höglander development path, I think the, you know, and I, by the way, I'd add Jack Rathbone too, right? Like, this is something the club has kind of done, is reward players who are maybe more hopefuls than, you know, like inside track to make the team guys with these sorts of deals, giving them some security to just come in and play. But also, you know, it's one of those ones where it's like, we know that he's going to get kind of first dibs on a look in the you know, let's say everyday lineup.
Yep.
out of the gate at training camp. But we also know that a 2-year commitment's at that level, not like that significant a commitment, right? There's still nothing guaranteed in terms of his ice time. And, you know, him, I've always thought that his skill set, what he should be given his work rate and professionalism and work ethic, right? Which is all stuff that, you know, I know of from behind the sink, like, a little more patient with a guy who
sure,
you know, is working hard at their craft. Even if in Pod Colson's case, I think there's occasionally been a problem where he thinks too much about it, where he almost works too hard as opposed to letting the game come to him. But, you know, with Pod Colson, he's obviously going to get a look. I think there's no way around, given the probability of multiple spots that are going to be like the club's going to need filled on the wings, like as high as the second line, as high as the top line, there is going to be space for some young forward to come in and make a case. And Pod Colson's sort of the one guy I think you can reasonably expect to at least fill an everyday lineup. Like the floor there, because of the size, because of the work rate, at least on a fourth line,
yep.
You know, I feel like we know that he's going to be able to do that, which isn't to say that the club's not going to change directions if it's not working or what have you. But I think we know that he's at least going to get sort of the first look and is probably the one player in the system that I think, you know, you can say stuff like, you know, Cole McWard is probably going to have a chance to compete with Noah Juulsen or something for like a 6-7 spot. But Pod Colson's kind of the one guy with the inside track. The club structured it that way. He's a player who deserves, I think, a little bit of patience, just given everything we know about him and obviously the upside. And so that's kind of the guy that stands out the most. I think it makes sense that we start there.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting one for me. Like, it's a really hard eval for me overall.
Well, and he stands out because of his age, of course, and because of where he is in his career and the new contract, the NHL experience relative to a lot of guys that we'll talk about here, but also just, as you said, because of the opportunity. And, you know, if you're looking at, as you said, like it's going to be forward spots open up and down the lineup, but the name that stands out to me where you can at least have maybe some degree of confidence or place a reasonable bet that, okay, can Pod Colson come in and fill this spot in the lineup if this player isn't back, is Sam Lafferty, right? Like, as you said, fourth line, size, speed. You hope Pod Colson bring a little bit more of the physicality more consistently than Sam Lafferty was able to. Now, I know Lafferty scored 13 goals this year, right? Because he had an incredible run of high shooting percentage. So is that too much for Vasily Pod Colson to clear? But that's the kind of like one-for-one replacement that stands out to me. And I will say, you know, look how often they use Sam Lafferty up the lineup this year, right? It's not like he was exclusively a fourth liner. So if Pod Colson's stepping into that role, there's also kind of going to be natural opportunities for him to move up the lineup at different points if his play is deserving of it.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's right, that's like the floor case of the job that you'd hope that Vasily Pod Colson can affordably replace.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you hope for, right? And that's kind of what's interesting about a lot of these guys, right? Like with Jonathan Lekaramäki, you hope that he's a one-for-one answer to this team's biggest offseason need, which is dynamic scoring off the wings. Like you hope that he comes in. And I mean, we've seen a lot of players produce, like he had the 14th most productive SHL season from a U20 player we've seen, mm-hmm. right? Like really good, fringe historic stuff. But aside from like the five or six guys at the very top of that list, your Kent Nilsson, Henrik and Daniel Sedin, Elias Pettersson, Peter Forsberg tier, right? And those guys are like 60 points, 50 points, as opposed to 31 with 19 goals. You know, most of the guys in and around Lekaramäki's range, it's like William Karlsson, not a full-time NHL player till his early 20s. You know, Emil Bemström, who had 20 points and then regressed. You know, Marcus Kruger, 2 years out at least from the NHL and also a defensive center.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for the most part, Calle Järnkrok obviously has had a tremendous career as a middle six guy, but also didn't break into the league till 22. The vast majority of his historical comps, like what history tells us, is that these players, even when they have really spectacular age 19 seasons in a really tough men's professional league over in Sweden, that doesn't necessarily mean they're ready to light the world on fire year one. And I think when we consider what Rick Tocchet hockey demands, right? The fact that players like Hoglander and Kuzmenko, some of those wingers have had trouble really cementing their roles
yep.
on this team and earning the sort of trust that we're talking about when we talk about what the Canucks need in their top six, you know, for all of that, all of those reasons to bet against them, like one thing that none of the guys I mentioned have in common with Lekaramäki is they weren't the 15th overall pick. They weren't a dominant goal scorer at the U20s,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, there's still reason to think that, hey, this guy actually can break the mold. And it's not a wild take. Like, you can make an argument that's actually compelling. It's not pure hope. but that doesn't mean you can build around expecting him, right, to necessarily come in. And I think that that applies to Podkolzin when we start to raise the bar on which sorts of roles he can fill next season, right? If you're talking about a one-for-one replacement with Sam Lafferty, I think we can all say, hey, that makes sense. You know, you certainly hope that he can, you know, your Podkolzin, Niels Amon, Phil DiGiuseppe fourth line, if that's how you open the season, that's not going to hurt you, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's an above-average fourth line in NHL terms, to be totally honest with you. But can he replace Dakota Joshua in a world where Joshua gets the bag from another team on July 1? Which we'll all be excited for him personally, even if obviously it would be great if the Canucks could retain him, because, you know, with the size profile, with what this team needs, I mean, that would be ideal. And we kind of saw Podkolzin put into and trialed in that role during Joshua's injury. And I think there were some good moments there, even if there wasn't anything like Dakota Joshua's level of production and play driving. So, you know, that's sort of where it becomes more hopeful. Like, if Dakota Joshua does depart in free agency, if the club can't find a way to come to terms with him on an agreeable extension, you know, can they afford to go into the season penciling Podkolzin into that slot? Can you go lower end? Can you bring in like a Christian Fisher so that there's competition for that spot? Or do you actually need to prioritize getting more physicality, and replacing a player who played top 6 minutes for you and was pretty impactful, by the way, in the Stanley Cup playoffs?
It feels like that's where it jumps from a reasonable expectation, right? Vasily Podkolzin coming in and playing Sam Lafferty's role to hope. And I think the thing about this team having the season they had is, and, you know, winning around in the playoffs, going to game seven in the second round. And yes, obviously, Patrick Alvin, quite memorably and quite rightly, saying it was just the second round. But when you exceed expectations and raise the bar, it becomes much, much more difficult to rely on hope bets, right? And sometimes hope bets work out. I think back to the North Division season and Nils Höglander starting in the top six, right? And that was kind of a hope bet. He had a really good year for them, but the reason he was in that spot is because they just didn't have enough top six forwards. They didn't have other options to put there, right? And it's one thing to do it in that situation, but coming off of this season, I don't think they can really afford to be making certainly more than one of those types of hope bets, right? And I think that's the thing with Lekkerin Mäki as well. You ideally want to have a well-fleshed-out, well-built-out top six ahead of options, with options ahead of Lekkerin Mäki that would make it very, very difficult for him to jump over them and get on the roster. And then if that's the case, you know, he's probably going back to the AHL. So I think it's just, it would seem like a pretty tough position to be in if you were counting on Vasily Podkolzin to replace Dakota Joshua. Like, that just seems like you've got this team that you want to keep advancing, you want them to keep taking a step forward, and I don't know if you're putting yourself in a position to do so if that's the kind of bet you're making.
You're right. And I think the only sort of mitigating circumstance there, like the counter argument I guess I'd make, is just because you open the season like that doesn't mean that's how you'll end it, right? And we know how fond of horse trading this front office and this management group can be. And, you know, I think there's also an element of this, right? Which is that, so I didn't want to roll it out yesterday because I know we'll talk about it all the time, but there's a promise in hiring Penguins brass, you know, the Pittsburgh boys that have come to Vancouver and had a smash success in their second year. There's a promise that comes with that to some extent of, I'm going to call it the promise of Mark Donk. Okay. There is the promise of Mark Donk. And one thing I think we know and have a lot of confidence in regarding this front office based on their work, and even based on their work when things didn't go well, right? Kuzmenko, Joshua, even despite mistakes like Mikheyev, right? When it comes to pro scouting under this regime, the Canucks have been very sharp, right? Like, excellent.
Yep.
And the fact remains is that this is a team with a lot of flexibility this offseason. Like, as much as we're talking about how this team's success comes attached to the double-edged sword that is a bunch of key contributors who were huge parts of this team are all lined up, poised, positioned to cash in a major way over the next 4 weeks. you know, the club's not facing that scenario with limited flexibility where you're talking about needing to buy guys out or attach sweeteners to get off of money. Like, this team has the ability to retain priority free agents, whoever they determine are those free agents, and still have the, you know, flex to take a big swing on some kind of upgrade, some kind of big, like a big ticket external upgrade to the defense corps or the forward group. And yet, when no matter what, when you're talking about this volume of possible departures or raises, right? Because it's one or the other. You know, when you're talking about two bottom six centermen, you're talking about, you know, two bona fide top nine contributors, one top six winger for a team that was already short a top six winger or two, right? I mean, there's a lot of balls in the air here, and I don't know how you build a team that has as much balance as the club that we saw last year did without
making some
needing
bets.
More.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what? No, but I mean, without needing more internally.
Yeah.
Like needing more from what you're developing internally than you can generate, even if you go out and recreate with 100% efficiency the extraordinary heater that this management group went on from a pro scouting perspective over the last 6-7 months. Like, this is where that run of bodies acquired through non-traditional means, where the ability to, you know, harvest some of those NCAA free agents, the ability to have a Cole McWard or a Max Sasson give you games, eat innings, and ideally more than that, right? Like, ideally doing more than that, you know, and that's sort of where I think we can still kind of look at where this team's positioned, acknowledging the dream campaign that we all just enjoyed, and say, okay, well, at the end of the day, from that perspective, from the promise of Mark Donk, it feels like there's a stretch to imagine that that's going to carry them or deliver next season. It could happen. Lekaramaki and Pod Colson are relatively high upside options. If you even get third line impact from one of them next season, you are laughing. That's a huge, but that's, you know, even that seems like a bar above what we would call reasonable expectations, right? If Cole McWard or Akito Hirose, or if you can get a guy or two that's able to come in and not just play third pair minutes for you or fill in or not harm you, but actually contribute, right? Yep. Actually, not the one for one, well, he can do most of what Sam Lafferty did, but that's actually an upgrade. That's now a position of strength. You actually got better and cheaper, because that's kind of the trick. That's what you're going to need to pull off as you allocate resources into, you know, maintaining the defensive solidity this team found, right? Effectively reconstructing the defense core, given all the guys in need of new contracts, four of them, really, among their NHL regulars, and graft that additional layer of offensive push that this team's so desperate for. That's sort of where the promise of Mark Donk, I think, needs to be something that we at least keep in the back of our mind as, like, we're going into year 3.5, basically, of this Rutherford-Alvin experiment. It's actually reasonable at this point to expect that the club would have some of that lower-end push. And it's going to be tough to manufacture in the years to come. We know this because of how many draft picks the team has traded. I do think it's incumbent on, you know, whether it's player development staff or the coaching staff, like, a couple of these guys are going to need to be meaningful contributors next season if this team's going to be as good as the 50-win, 109-point team. High bar, I know, that we saw this season.
Well, and to your point about can the team be as balanced? And it might be a case where you have to sacrifice some of that balance, right, in order to improve, in order to raise the ceiling at the top of the lineup. And, you know, I was saying it's a tough ask to ask Dakota Joshua to, or sorry, Vasily Podkolzin to come in and replace what Dakota Joshua did for them. But I guess another way to look at it would be, okay, if you are saving, you know, $2 million plus going from Dakota Joshua to Vasily Podkolzin, and that's enabling you to go out and get a really, really good player, like somebody who truly moves the needle at the top of your lineup, well, your third line might not be better, but can you make up for that? Or your third line is probably going to be worse, but can you make up for that in the top six? And again, it's a question of team building, right? It's not as balanced, but those are the sorts of decisions that they're going to have to confront this summer. And maybe it does end up, as you said, kind of relying on somebody like Podkolzin to be a truly meaningful contributor. By the way, you referenced Mark Donk a couple of times there, and somebody texted it in. What's a donk? So I'll allow you to explain the Mark Donk reference for those that are not in the know on the Twitter meme from the Penguins days.
Yeah, there's a there's an old hockey Twitter joke, one of the classics, but from A.T. Fooleman, acting the Fooleman is his username, and he is
Mark Spector's
the
bud.
Only funny Leafs fan. Sorry?
Mark Spector's best bud.
Oh, man. His Spector parodies are actually pretty well written. The you can't serve soup in a sieve line that he used as a fake lead about Jack Campbell was honestly one of, like, I wish I'd written that, you know, like, it's so good. Anyway, the Penguins always have like 8 injuries and 12 call-ups I've never heard of. The call is like Malkin gains the zone with wingers Mark Donk and Buzz Fisbit, and you look and they both have 47 points. So this is, you know, a throwback to the, like, before Rust was Rust and before Gensel was Gensel and before, you know, Bluger was Bluger and on, right? Like, all these guys who just seemed to come out of nowhere and be huge supporting pieces for that Penguins team when they were on their back-to-back cup-winning run under Rutherford and Alvin. So that's the promise of Mark Donk. The idea that, you know, we're going to be the team, the Canucks are going to be the team that's annoying other fan bases because they're like, and the Canucks have taken a 3-1 lead on a goal from Max Sasson. What a find for this organization, right? Like, that's the promise of Mark Donk. And, you know, I'm not writing it off, right? Like, I'm not writing off the ability of Lekaramäki and Pod Colson and some other guys to deliver, to be dark horses, to push to make this team. But I do think it's fair to note, you know, from the perspective of where we sit now, aside from Arturs Seelovs being like a one-for-one for Casey DeSmith, it feels like a lot of the other replacement options, the internal options, feel a little bit hopeful as we approach the meat of the NHL offseason.
And we should say, you know, part of that approach in Pittsburgh, and I don't even think, like, Pod Colson, I think you could sell fitting into that mold, although he was a first-round pick, a high first-round pick, of course, but, you know, like, Brian Rust, third-round pick, drafted in 2010, played 4 years of college, didn't make his debut until the 2014-2015 season. You know, Teddy Bluger, of course, was in the minors for a long time. Like, part of that approach was really, really giving guys time to develop in the minors. So as much as that has been a hallmark of their management style and the way they've gone about their business in Pittsburgh, it's also about having the patience, not trying to force it, right? Not saying like, oh, can this guy solve all our problems? It's about giving them all the time they need to develop before they're ready to really contribute to the NHL team. Okay, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. We got to take a break here. Just really quickly, Drance, do you have anything to say about Luke Gazdick and everything? Do we need to weigh in on that? People are texting in a lot. Like, hey, are you guys going to talk about it? When are you getting to it? We can maybe do it a little bit later. I don't have a lot to say, but I think most of it's already been said in the market.
Yeah, these are those ones where I'm just like pretty out of step with the market. Don't be the main character on Twitter, kids. That's my take.
Always good advice. All right, maybe we'll dip into that a little bit later on in the show. But up next, we'll look at the Stanley Cup final matchup, which is set. Sean Gentile from The Athletic joins us next here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650.
Hey, it's Vic Nizar. Have your say and join me on The People's Show with big takes and even bigger bets weekdays 3 to 4 on Sportsnet 650 or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd. It's Thomas Drance. We are live from the Kintec studio. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber with 3 stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center or Arbutus in Vancouver. Online at DunbarLumber.com. Now joining us to look way ahead, way into the distant future when the Stanley Cup Finals will get going. He covers the NHL for The Athletic. Always a pleasure to have on the show. He is Sean Gentile. Sean, what's going on, man?
Fellas, how we doing? Drancer, were you on vacation a week or two ago? Is that what it was?
Drance was driving down to California. Drance does like 3 weeks of remote shows in California every time around this time of year.
He's got it all figured out. I've become very aware of his recording schedule and whatever. He's a genius.
He's got all the angles covered.
It's the only thing I do well, but I do it well. Sean, can I pitch you on a narrative that I like for this Stanley Cup final? You ready?
Hit me.
I think this is the season where we need to accept that in the contemporary NHL, with declining save percentage and shooters, you know, growing up with composite sticks and YouTube, offense now rules. And this is the series that pits the two teams that most reliably generate quality looks and have a high enough defensive baseline. You can't fake it, but you need to be able to generate sick shots on a regular basis if you're not going to fall off a cliff against elite opponents in the Stanley Cup playoffs. This final is proof of it. You buying or selling?
That's like a hard buy for me. I've been there, man, last season, possibly. Like, I feel like what we need in our capacity is, you know, media that covers this sport. I think it's something we need to stress pretty continually. Like, goalies are playing from behind now. That's just the way it is. And it's something as simple as, you know, go on to Hockey Reference and look at the year-by-year save percentage and look at how that's declined, you know, pretty precipitously over the last 7 or 8 or 9 seasons. So we're there for me, regardless of what happens in this final, right? Like, I think that now, could this be the event that kind of drives all this home and really makes it clear, like beyond a shadow of a doubt for a larger population, that that goal scorers or offense or skaters kind of rule the roost? Absolutely. And I hope it does, because it's true. I think we need to recalibrate how we think, what we think dominant hockey teams look like. And I also think we need to recalibrate what a good goaltender looks like, because people's sense for that, I think, has gotten kind of out of whack, because we saw so many years of, you know, you got to have a 920 to be considered a really good goaltender, and that's not where we are either. So I think it's something we all need to internalize for sure.
With this matchup in particular, I do think the Panthers are probably slightly better defensively, but I mean, is this Oilers team now at a point where we're going to be talking about their attack, you know, for like decades? Like, that was a team that, man, they could get goals. Like, have they hit that level where this is something we'll remember beyond, you know, regardless of how this Stanley Cup final turns out?
It feels like the leveling up that we've seen from Evan Bouchard has kind of taken them into that territory, doesn't it? Like, now it's not just, you know, top six is dangerous and they have to, you know, two all-time greats at this point in the mix. And yeah, there's other guys that can score or whatever. Now they have that force on the back end, that offensive force that it's necessary to have whenever you're talking about an all-time offensive team, or even, you know, a true elite team going back during the, let's say, the Cap era, right? Like, you need Evan Bouchard, just like you needed Drew Doughty or Duncan Keith or Chris Letang or whatever. You need one of those guys. And I think his explosion over the last 6 months or 9 months, I think, puts him in that category. Like, they grayed out in a way that they didn't before, for sure.
There's lots of enticing matchups here in this series, but you know, you look at the top of the forward lineups, right? And you expect to see the Selke winner, Sasha Barkov, go up against Connor McDavid. And even beyond that, you know, Barkov has Sam Reinhart, elite goal scorer and a great defensive player, to kind of match up alongside Zach Hyman on that line as well. And I mean, that's fantastic, right? The Selke winner against the best offensive forward in the sport going head to head in the Stanley Cup final. how much success does Barkov need to have in that matchup, right? Because he probably doesn't need to win it. It's hard to do that against McDavid. Does it need to be break even? Does it need to be? Does he just need to limit the damage? What does Barkov need to do in that matchup to give the Panthers a chance to win?
It's a great question, and also it's that forward line, and it's also Forsling and Aaron Ekblad who've, you know, really been out there at every turn against whether it was the Kucherov line in round one or Pasternak in round two or, you know, the Panarin line in round three. It's been pretty much a hard match for all five of those guys, honestly, against the most dangerous players on the opponent's roster, right? So I don't think that they need to shut them down to the degree that they shut down Kucherov and Pasternak and Panarin, because those guys, you know, no one's going to Artemi Panarin had two secondary assists at 5-on-5 in six games. Like, ain't happening with Connor McDavid. So I don't think we need to judge them necessarily, you know, by the work that they've done in the first three rounds. But I think, you know, break even or something close to it, I think would be judged as a success. I will say, you know, if you look, especially in the last two rounds against Boston in particular, the Pasternak line got chances. They won high danger chances against the Barkov line and the Forsling pairing pretty decisively. So the results were great, and I think they deserve credit for not, you know, that the Panthers deserve credit for not allowing those high danger chances to turn into goals. But they've leaked a little oil at certain points throughout the playoffs, and it's really come down to those guys, you know, whether it's Panarin, Kucherov, Pasternak, like not really capitalizing on the chances. So I don't know if you necessarily want to lose, you know, get out chance 2-1 like they did against Pasternak against McDavid. I don't think that's going to work out, but the results have been what they've been. I think as long as they tread water, relatively speaking, we'll be fine.
And, you know, another similarity between these teams, and I know you guys highlighted it in your preview at The Athletic, right? The star power beyond the first line. So obviously Leon Draisaitl, when he is playing on his own line for the Oilers, and Matthew Tkachuk for the Panthers. And, you know, two guys that have really established themselves as premier playoff performers, clutch guys over the last few seasons in the NHL. What do you expect to see out of that matchup? Do you think it can favor one team or the other decisively here?
Man, that's such a great question, and it feels like on some level that the series is gonna—I don't know—that might be overstating it, but it feels like a game or two or three is gonna hinge on who wins that matchup. Honestly, there's something about the Panthers. I don't know. I might be living in the past. I might be living in 2023, but I love that second line so much for Florida. And I don't know. It's tough for me to pick against them. Great as Draisaitl is, and, you know, as much of an unreal playoff performer as he's proven himself to be, I think if you're making me choose, I'm taking Bennett, I'm taking Tkachuk over Edmonton second line. But man, it feels like a coin flip.
Sean, one of the other stories I think is the rise of two blue chip defensemen who maybe weren't considered among that tier prior to this postseason. And I think going forward very clearly will be Evan Bouchard and Gustav Forsling. If you were to rate or rank like your top five Conn Smythe candidates, would they both be on that list?
Ooh, that's a great question. I think at this point, I would say that Bouchard is definitely there, and Forsling, you know, he's on the edge of the conversation. Five, six, I don't know. He's close, but that's more a testament to how overwhelming Bouchard's looked at times, honestly, because I don't want to knock Gustav Forsling at all, because, like, it seems like every game he's making some crazy, you know, play on the puck or whatever. Like, he's noticeable defensively in a way that not a lot of other guys are. So, full points But Bouchard just is like, he seems like he gets better every game. And I think, you know, if we're talking a week or two from now and, you know, we're looking back on who indeed deserved the Conn Smythe when it's all said and done, it's hard. If the Oilers win, it's hard to imagine Bouchard not being second or third on the list. He's been phenomenal.
And here's another opportunity for a hot take, a layup for a hot take. If you want it, you can also, of course,
when have I ever turned that down? Please.
We're like clearing out Wembanyama, clear path to the hoop for you here. Are we sure that Florida has an edge in net in this series?
I am not a Bobrovsky guy. I feel like I'm going, but I also feel like I'm going down with a ship. I've said like multiple times over the last couple years, I think part of this is because the series when he was with Philly, it was Philly versus Pittsburgh. It happened early in my career and he got benched and he was just awful. And I think that's colored everything that I've seen from Sergei Bobrovsky over the last like 10 years or 15 years. Like, I feel like I'm being unfair to him on some level, but I see meltdown potential in him. I still do. And that sounds insane after the 2023 postseason he had, right? Like, he's the best player on the ice most nights, but I still think that playoff Bob is, I'm not locked in on that being a real thing. I think there is absolutely meltdown potential in that for Florida. Absolutely. But I've thought that for also the last, you know, 2 or 3 years and haven't really been proven correct. So whatever.
Well, it does just feel though that like if any team is going to create that meltdown, it's the one with Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl. Like, that would make those guys shooting on Bobrovsky would make me nervous if I was a Panthers fan, for sure.
Totally. And it's like they relied, you know, not to knock Panarin and Pasternak and the Lightning guys or whatever, but like those dudes had their chances. They had their opportunities and they couldn't quite capitalize on them. Some of that, of course, is due to Bobrovsky, and some of that, you know, is due to their own failure. So it depends, I guess, on what side of the coin you're looking at. Like, all I know is, man, if we're talking, like I said before, if we're talking about Edmonton getting two high danger chances for every one that the Panthers get, it's gonna be ugly.
How big a role do you expect the special teams battle to play in this series? I think it's notable that these are the two best penalty kills in the Stanley Cup playoffs, meeting in the finals. Of course, you know, we all know what Edmonton's power play can do, but they have just been absolutely phenomenal on special teams. The Panthers are no slouches either in that department. I mean, like, it feels like a series where if one power play is able to kind of get over on the other PK, that could swing the series for their team.
100%. And when did you guys kind of internalize the idea that the Oilers have a good PK? Because I'm not sure I'm there yet.
In the Canucks series, watching it.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that's true. I like the proof in the pudding on that one. But I don't know. I like watching Dallas's power play. I thought so much of that was like, I thought some of that was on them. Like I whatever, give the Oilers credit where it's due. I guess I rate what Florida's PK did against the Rangers a little bit more highly than what the Oilers have done, you know, at least what they did against Dallas. So, but at the same time, you know, good as the Rangers power play is, it ain't the Oilers. Right. So it's a whole different beast. And both of them have been pretty good. And I think it's, you know, we all love talking about 5-on-5, and it's true, because that's like the main stake for most of the game. But a lot of series are still won and lost on special teams, man. I think this one's no different.
The Oilers, what's your take on this? It's felt to me like the playoffs, in general, have been, I mean, don't get me wrong. There's still moments like the last 4 minutes of Stars Oilers where you know that prison rules apply and that the only thing that's going to cause anyone to be penalized is the worst infraction in hockey, putting the puck over the glass. Everything else goes. With this playoffs, though, I feel like those moments have been further and farther between. It's actually felt like there's been a number, like a fair number of games that have been called pretty straight up. It, almost like we'd expect it, you know, in the regular season as opposed to what we're used to at the pointy end of Stanley Cup playoff series.
A lot of that's anecdotal, but I feel the same way. I mean, we have someone on staff at the Athletic, like whether it's me or McIndoo or, you know, somebody each night, our job is to kind of be on call and in case something egregious happens, right? In case we get, you know, the horrific missed call or the whatever, some kind of officiating based controversy. And the reason that's the way, like, because that's the way it's been for years. Like, you can count, it felt like you could count on a certain number of, you know, brutal series swinging calls or missed calls or decisions or whatever. And that hasn't been the case this year. I mean, like, that's not to say that we haven't had some, because you're not going to make it through a zillion hockey games over the course of 2 months without at least a handful. But man, anecdotally, based on last year, year before that, it feels like it's down for sure. And I don't have a problem with that. Like, it doesn't make for good radio. It doesn't make for good posts or whatever. But I'll take it because it makes the results feel a little bit more legitimate and a little bit more earned. And whenever you're talking about that, I don't think that's ever a bad thing.
With the overall matchup here, like, I can't get the Canucks out of my head when I think about this series, not because, you know, it's Canucks talk and I cover them and on, but because some of what Vancouver did that did occasionally give the Oilers problems, and in my opinion, there wasn't that much of it aside from Oilers goaltending was really, really bad. But yeah, I do think when the Canucks looked good in that series, whether it was the second half of game one, whether it was the early part of game three, whether it was all of game five, it was their pressure game. It was their forecheck that actually was able to play against that Oilers defense until Knobloch found some answers as the series went along. And there is nobody better with down ice pressure, nobody better at getting home on the forecheck than this Florida Panthers team. Is there anything instructive from that matchup, or do I just have, you know, this like Canucks sickness?
No, man, I think you're right to say that. And I think that credit to Knobloch for finding some kind of mix that works, right? You break up Nurse and CC and you know, you start cycling guys in and out. That was clearly like a necessary thing. But the principles of you know, game two and game three and game five, that are like you said, they're still in there somewhere, right? Like, it's hard not to look at Darnell Nurse out there at times. I know he'd been better. He was better against the Stars as that series went on, but it's hard not to look at him and be like, this guy is, you know, could be some issues, right? Like, he could be someone to target. Cody Ceci still could be someone to target. They're not, you know, playing 19 minutes a game together anymore, but they're still scattered throughout that lineup. And when you have, you know, three lines really that can forecheck and generate offense from the forecheck and generate quality chances from the forecheck and finish on those quality chances, because I think on some level, you know, you got to treat the Anton Lundell line in the same sort of way at this point. You know, it's tough not to imagine that there's some soft spots there for sure, because we saw it and you guys saw it, you know, at various points throughout that series. I totally agree with you.
Yeah, I mean, even if it's not the Nurse CC disaster pairing, as you said, like, there's still vulnerabilities there beyond the Ekholm Bouchard pairing for the Edmonton Oilers. And I think that's going to play a big, big role in this series. Sean, always appreciate the time, man. Thank you for doing this. And hopefully we'll all find a way to fill the time without hockey until this series gets going.
Yeah, if you guys want me to come on in a couple days.
Yeah, we do like another preview of it with all the new developments since now.
We can just talk about that Jim Henson documentary that's on Apple TV that I'm watching in bits and pieces here if you want. We'll figure it out.
We'll find something. Thank you for doing this, buddy.
All right, fellas.
That is Sean Gentile from The Athletic weighing in on the Stanley Cup final. And yeah, great big deep dive series preview on from not just Gentile, but also Dom L and Shayna Goldman as well. Up at The Athletic that you can check out right now. And they have it as a true coin flip, Drancer, a 50-50 between the Florida Panthers and the Edmonton Oilers in the Stanley Cup final.
Yeah, I mean, 50.3%, I believe, is the Panthers' yep. edge as the favorite.
Massive
Vegas
favorites.
Vegas had it at plus 100 for the Oilers, minus 120 for the Panthers. And by the way, one of the major U.S. sports books posted 2025 Stanley Cup outrights today.
Are you so
excited?
You
know how excited I was?
I can imagine how excited you are. Yeah.
The Vancouver Canucks 20-1.
Okay.
To win the Stanley Cup behind Los Angeles, behind Winnipeg,
ooh.
You know, a host of other teams. Almost like 12th or 13th best odds. Like it's in the middle. It's very much not Vegas looking at Vancouver and saying this is a team on the rise that we expect to be better than last year. You can take from that what you want. But I just thought that was interesting. It's our first, like, objective gut check on mm-hmm. sort of how Vegas sees this team and rates this team. And, you know, I guess a fair bit of that reflects, two, not just, you know, the repeatability of this Canucks season, but also all of the unsigned free agents that the club will navigate contract talks with over the next month.
Yeah, no doubt about it, right? When there's that much uncertainty going into it, you understand it as well. Who's number one? Oilers?
Yeah, Oilers.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But narrowly, it's like it's an inner circle that are all at about 9, 9.5 to 1. Some of the values that stood out to me, though, Vegas 12 to 1. They have like the 7th or 8th best odds. I like that. The Philadelphia Flyers were at 550 to 1. Like plus 550.
Okay.
Plus 5,500. So 55 to 1. And that's a team that had an elite defense. And if they get Michkov over this season, as there's some speculation they might, like you're grafting a pretty good structure, like some elite talent onto a pretty good structural team. I think that's, as the long shot bids go, that's interesting. At least more interesting than me just saying couple of.
I'm not sure Philly's going to clear the elite offensive bar, though. Like, even with Michkov. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, because I think you're right. The point you made to Gentile off the top. Like, you need to be able to generate high-quality scoring chances at a really high level, and I don't know if Philly's going to get there.
Yeah. I mean, Philly was one of the better shot generation teams 5-on-5, but it does feel like some of that, you know, like the top 4 5-on-5 shot generation teams, yes, it includes Florida and Edmonton, but it also includes LA and Carolina.
Mm.
And like, we all kind of know that like some of those shots are nutritious, a well-balanced meal, and some of them are empty calories,
not so much.
A bag of Doritos.
Okay, yeah. We'll take a break here. Keep your text coming in, 650-650. We have an open segment to wrap up the show. But up next, Daniel Wagner from Pasta Tabulis covering the Canucks for Vancouver is awesome. He will join us. We'll talk a little Philip Roenick, Canucks offseason, and also Wagner's new book on the Canucks history at the NHL draft. That is coming up next here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650.